Good afternoon. I'm going to call to order this March 9th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. Welcome everyone who's here, committee members. Today we are going to have a couple of hearings on the issue of wage theft, and then one following up on our discussion last week on pay equity and giving the state more capacity to deal with that. And then we have a couple of work sessions, we hope. We're still waiting for paperwork to come on those. So we'll start with Senate Bill 718, which was a committee bill from a couple weeks ago. And I will open that public hearing, and I will bring forward with great eagerness our Commissioner Brad Avakian and Representative Jessica Vega Peterson. Oh, yeah. And while they're coming up, Matt, could you tell us what this bill does?
All right, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 718 defines wages for certain wage claims and requires employers to maintain time and pay records of terminated employees for 3 years from the date of termination, to provide records to the employee if requested, and to provide the employee with a written statement for reasons of termination. It modifies information that must be included in itemized statements provided to employees each pay period and establishes a civil right of action for certain wage claims for unpaid wages and for violation of certain wage statutes. The measure specifies procedures for establishing lien for amount of unpaid wages and authorizes the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to void notice of lien if Commissioner determines that the employees failed to establish a prima facie case for wage claim. The measure prohibits waiver of rights and prohibits determination by the employer against the employee for certain actions taken by the employee related to wage claims.
Thank you, Matt. Representative, would you like to start?
Yes, thank you.
Great.
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us here today. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I'm the state representative for House District 47 in East Portland. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak this afternoon in support of Senate Bill 718, the 2015 Fair Wage Recovery Act. I was glad to see this as a committee bill. I did work over this summer with the Northwest Workers Justice Project in taking a look at the issue of wage theft and what steps we could take here in Oregon in order to work on this issue. I'm proud to represent this bill as a culmination of meaningful discussions with that group. The problem that this legislation seeks to solve is that of wage theft. It simply is the failure to pay workers the wages that are owed to them. While most employers in our communities do right by their workers, too many do not. And that leads to an epidemic of wage theft in our communities. And that wage theft can be anything from being paid less than minimum wage, being shorted hours, being forced to work off the clock, not being paid overtime, or even not being paid at all. These are pervasive practices. There was an Oregon study of nearly 200 farm workers, and it found that 90% consistently received less than their minimum wage. These shocking numbers are echoed nationally. There was a seminal study of 4,500 low-wage workers in diverse industries, and it found that more than two-thirds experienced at least one pay-related violation in the previous week, including a quarter who were paid less than minimum wage and three-quarters who were not paid overtime wages. Although wage theft hits immigrants and communities of color the hardest, it happens across all industries, race, and immigration statuses. Wage theft happens in large companies as well as small businesses. The consequences are severe and widespread. We know that wage theft impacts workers. When that happens, their bills go unpaid, their housing is unstable, and families have less money for food or medical expenses. It also has an impact in our local economies. Well-meaning businesses struggle to compete with other businesses that shave their operating costs by breaking the law. And the less money that wage earners bring home, the less that they have to spend in their local communities. And we know that wage theft impacts taxpayers. Wage theft also robs government budgets of taxes and contributions to critical programs like unemployment insurance and workers' compensation. Today, we have a chance to provide workers with a simple, powerful set of tools that will help level the playing field for workers and law-abiding employers, and also strengthen our communities and local economies in the bargain. Senate Bill 718 does six main things. It makes it easier for workers who do essential functions of a small business to show that they are employees of that business. It puts teeth behind employers' obligations to provide accurate and detailed pay stubs. It requires employers to explain in writing why a worker was let go if the worker asks. It ensures attorney fee provisions do not create a barrier for workers standing up to enforce their rights. It standardizes the definition of wages to clarify what workers are entitled to receive, and it expands the ability of workers to get a lien for unpaid wages on employers' property. Providing workers with these new tools is essential to ensure that legal protections like minimum wage, overtime, and decent working conditions become a reality for all workers in our community. To illustrate the effects of wage theft on working families in Oregon, I want to share two short stories. We all know how hard it is to find a good job as a single parent. There was one single Oregon mother with two school-aged children who thought she had found something good, a flexible schedule and a steady income. What she had to do was to monitor the conditions of houses that were empty after foreclosure. But she was paid not a minimum wage, but instead $4 per house. She also was not paid for traveling across a tri-county area to go and visit each house, and she was not paid extra if she had to go back and visit those houses for additional monitoring. Because of all of those factors, her pay amounted to significantly less than what the minimum wage was, and it was nowhere near enough to support her and her family. A second young parent, a father, and the breadwinner for his family, he worked long hours in construction. He was a skilled worker, and he earned a good wage, $25 an hour, working 60 hours a week. However, shortly after he started working at this business, his boss stopped showing up for work. Although he was insured by other employees higher up at the site, he was told to keep working and that they would make sure that he got paid, but he never got paid. Without his income, his family lost their home and had to move in with an uncle. His marriage struggled under the strain of hard decisions about how to spend their diminishing savings. We know that wage theft has a huge impact on our families here in Oregon. Researcher Fabiola Santigo of UCLA's Labor Center wrote in August 2014, "We found that wage theft is not just an economic loss. It also means consequences for workers' health and their families. When wage theft drives low incomes even lower, workers find it difficult to afford adequate housing, healthy food, or other resources. This affects workers' health, putting them at risk for chronic diseases such as diabetes, hypertension, and mental health issues. It also means they can't afford medication for serious health conditions. The Fair Wage Recovery Act is needed to protect workers who may not speak up because of fear of retaliation and the struggle to find assistance in enforcing their rights. Passing Senate Bill 718 will help put an end to wage theft by making it harder for law-breaking employers to hide and easier for workers to get help and recover their wages. With that, I would glad to be answer any questions from the panel regarding the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Why don't we hear from the commissioner first? Commissioner, it's an honor to have you back.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Brad Avakian, Commissioner of Labor and Industries, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 718. Workers in Oregon deserve to be paid every dime that they're owed on time and in full. And at the same time, the vast majority of Oregon employers that do play by the rules deserve to be able to compete on a level playing field. It's just a matter of basic fairness to everybody. And that's why we've worked hard at BOLI over the years to make sure that workers do receive every dime that they've earned. We do that in various ways, through strong enforcement, but also through employer training, so that employers don't get into trouble inadvertently in the first place. But we know that there's challenges. There are millions of dollars over the years that the Bureau has not been able to collect because employers, for one reason or another, are able to dodge paying the amount that they've been ordered to pay to their workers. I know that Janet Bauer from the Oregon Center for Public Policy is going to give you some good statistics in that regard. We're advocating this session for bills that would increase BOLI's effectiveness in combating wage theft. We think those are important in order to strengthen our ability to enforce the law. But workers in Oregon that are shortchanged what they have earned can either go to the Bureau of Labor and Industries or they can go to court and have their claim pursued there. And we think those that choose to go to court also need to have ample protections. Senate Bill 718 adds simple and effective new tools to the wage theft toolbox, tools that make it harder for law-breaking employers to hide their wrongdoing and harder for them to get away with not paying the workers every dime that they are entitled to. And for those reasons, we heartily support 718 and encourage you to pass it out of committee. Now, there may be others in the room that are more suited to answer specific questions with regard to Senate Bill 718, but I'm more than pleased to do what I can if the committee has any questions for me.
Thank you. Questions, colleagues?
Yes, Senator Knope, please. I'm not sure which one of you would like to take this one, but on page 7, lines 3 and 4, it talks about attorney's fees, and it looks like that there's been a major change in the way, or actually who can collect them. So it says the court may award reasonable attorney's fees to a prevailing party, but party's been taken away, and it says plaintiff. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me why we've moved in that direction, or if there's something somewhere else in the bill that makes that a little more balanced?
Thank you, Chair Denbrough. Senator Knope, really what this does, it makes Oregon minimum wage law consistent with other parts of Oregon and federal wage and hour law, as well as Oregon and federal civil rights laws. So the type of provisions exist to make sure that the most vulnerable workers have reduced barriers for them to bring forward a case that enforce their rights.
So, follow up?
Yes.
So we don't want to allow the business, the small business, to have the ability to collect any attorney's fees if they prevail in the action?
Senator Denbrough and Senator Knope, we have what we found is that it's hard a lot of times for workers to find lawyers to represent them in these cases because a lot of the amounts of money that are being talked about are so small in terms of what a lawyer would get. This is to help ensure that the lawyers have incentive to take on those cases and the workers who are bringing these cases forward have good representation in these cases.
So follow up?
Please.
So where the small business prevails and, you know, you could argue that the case might have been frivolous or they just didn't have enough evidence or whatever. There's obviously a cost there to the small business for doing that. So under this bill, you're not looking to have the business reimbursed in any way for their costs when they actually win one of these cases.
That's not how it's written right now.
Thank you.
Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
I learned a new term today. It's called Liz Pendants or something like that, and I'm not even sure if I'm saying it the right way, but it has something to do with attaching, you know, the real property for lawsuits. And I was wondering if any other state allows this sort of scenario for wage claims to, you know, for an employer's property to be, even before a judgment is entered, to be given that notice of Liz Pendants. Are you aware of any other state?
Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, I don't know the answer to that question, but there possibly could be somebody coming up in a subsequent panel who might be able to answer that.
Thank you.
So that's a request for anyone who comes after.
Yes.
If you know anything about this,
Liz
please
Pendants.
Bring it forward. Don't wait for us to ask. Great. Any other? Yes.
I do have some.
Please.
Other questions. On page 5 of the bill, lines 29 through 33, talks about maintaining records for up to 3 years when an employee is terminated. And I thought maybe the commissioner would know, how does that mesh with other records that a business has to keep as it relates to employees or payroll and that type of thing?
Mr. Chair, Senator, rather than just shooting from the hip on the various aspects of record keeping from a business, I can tell you I don't know of another one that requires a 3-year period, but of course we're trying to do something here that that more effectively gets at an area that's difficult for employees. But I'd be happy and can very easily get you the sections that have to do with current record-keeping requirements.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Thank you. Why 3 years? Why not 1 year? Why not 24 months? As a small business owner or former small business owner, when you move and there's the opportunity for those records to disappear, get lost, not know where they are, and the longer period that we stretch that out, the more likely that is to occur, which I assume there's some penalty. I didn't look to see what the penalty was, but for not having the records, but why so long a time frame?
Yeah, if you don't have an answer, we can ask subsequently.
Well, in all fairness, Mr. Chair and Senator, the senator was looking right at me when he asked the question, but I can only answer to you this way. This is not the Bureau's bill. We support the bill,
right.
But I mention it only because we weren't involved in the drafting of it. We do not believe that it's an unreasonable amount of time in order to keep records for a three-year period.
Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
I think the Commissioner could answer this question. Because a person would have to, or an employer would have to give, written notice, or not written notice, but a written explanation as to why a person was, as I understand it, fired, or is that moving us away from right at-will employment, do you think?
Mr. Chair, Senator, Oregon is currently an at-will employment state. The current law is that an employer does not have to have a reason for discharging an employee. They cannot discriminate based on race, religion, gender, disability, age, and the other protected classes. And so this would require an employer, as I read it, if there's a reason, to provide the reason to the employee.
So I guess it could be a blank piece of paper because it doesn't have to be a reason. I don't know. I'm curious.
Chair Dembro, mm-hmm. Vice Chair Thatcher. I believe that this gets at the issue when there have been conflicting or changing reasons why an employee has been terminated. It does not do anything, or the intent is not to do anything to change an employer's right in terms of termination in state to continue to be an at-will state. But it will. The hope is that it would prevent, have a consistent reason when there is a reason to be given.
Senator Knope.
Commissioner, is there any criminal charges for wage theft for this type of a relationship?
Mr. Chair, Senator, with respect to violating a commissioner's order, there is. If I give an order to pay wages and the order is not followed, it's subject to being a Class A misdemeanor and $6,250 in penalties. Other than that, I do not know of any criminal penalty for failing to pay wages.
Okay. But I applaud you guys for attempting to solve the problem, because I think we would all agree that wage theft is wrong, and I mean it's theft. So in that way, you know, I think it's criminal. But I just want to make sure that we're balancing this in terms of a small business's ability to adhere with the law, because as you said, we want them to comply with your order. And I think we want them to be able to comply generally with whatever law we pass, and that it's fair and balanced as it relates to their ability to pay their employees. And then because believe it or not, there are actual claims that probably aren't legitimate. And then I think we've proven through testimony in this committee that there are clearly instances, many, $7 million worth of unpaid wages? So clearly there are significant instances where there's a problem, where it needs to be addressed. And so I just want to make sure we're solving the right problem, not creating additional opportunities for small businesses to incur expenses that they otherwise shouldn't.
Agreed.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And we will be hearing, I think, from some business representatives. Okay, thank you, both of you, for...
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
...for kicking this off. Okay, I'm going to call up Janet Bauer and Bonnie Allen Saylor, please. Janet, were you going to give us the numbers? Is that why you're here?
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, yes, I will attempt to. My name is Janet Bauer again, and I'm from I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. As I testified a couple weeks ago, we are a research institute and have been looking at the extent and impact of wage theft in Oregon for a while. First of all, we have one of our primary sources of information is the BOLI wage claims data. And in sum, in short, we find, based on that data, wage theft in Oregon to be persistent and pervasive. Because not all victimized workers file wage claims with BOLI, they may not know BOLI is there to help, or they may pursue private enforcement. The wage claims data from BOLI can be considered the tip of the iceberg of wage theft in Oregon. Additionally, not all workers feel comfortable bringing forward a claim because typically they're anxious about their job. But still, the BOLI data can tell us a bit about that tip of the iceberg. Specifically, over the past most recent eight-year period, 12,000 Oregonians brought forward claims worth $35 million. To put that amount in context, that is twice the amount of the value of property stolen in robbery cases in Oregon. Fortunately, we can know a little bit more about the scope of wage theft, generally speaking, across the country, although, as I said, the wage theft data from BOLI is limited in that regard. As mentioned earlier, there's a groundbreaking study conducted a couple years ago of several wage theft in several cities in the country, and that study surveyed low-wage workers. What they found was two-thirds of low-wage workers in the study had experienced some form of wage theft in the previous week. The fact that low-wage workers did struggle with wage theft does speak to the vulnerability of that group of individuals and the lack of employment security typically. Further, there's a recent very valuable analysis done by the U.S. Department of Labor recently released that looked at U.S. Census data and minimum wage violations in several states, not including Oregon. They found that of the minimum wage of the workers in states subject to minimum wage law, between 3.5 and 6.5 of them had experienced minimum wage violations. The lost earnings represented a large share of their earnings. Of those who had experienced wage theft, their losses represented between 37% and 71% of their earnings. Further, thousands of them were in poverty when they otherwise would not have been and were eligible for a number of public benefits when they otherwise would not have been. There were lost state revenues. They measured the lost revenues by several surveys, census surveys. Depending on which one they use, those lost state revenues ranged from $8 million to $14 million in the year 2011, depending on this, and those were for each state involved. So were they to be able to capture all kinds of wage theft, not just minimum wage, but the other kinds of forms that wage theft does happen in Oregon? This report does raise concerns about the extent of wage theft that is occurring in Oregon were we able to directly assess it. So briefly, back to Oregon, why do some Oregon employers appear to build a business model on cheating workers? I testified last month before this committee that as a group, employers end up paying just 28% of the amount that our agency finds they owe workers. It appears unscrupulous employers may have found that cheating does pay. The fact that employers are able to escape paying nearly three-quarters of what they owe despite Boley's best efforts points to systemic weaknesses that allow wage theft to continue in Oregon. Your action on Senate Bill 718 will help change the name of the game in Oregon with respect to wage theft by providing updated, stronger tools to hold employers accountable. Your action will help make the economic hardship of wage theft for Oregon working families and costly state consequences a thing of the past. Thank you very, very much for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you, Janet. Bonnie?
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bonnie Allen Saylor. I'm a staff attorney with the Northwest Workers Justice Project, and I'm also here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition to Stop Wage Theft, which is a coalition of over 35 labor, faith, business, and community groups that have joined together to try and combat wage theft. I'm planning to be very brief. You've already heard a lot about wage theft, you know, how persistent and pervasive of a practice it is. It's also a complex issue, and it comes in many forms. Because of this, it necessarily demands a multifaceted approach, which is what we're trying to do with this bill. We have two things we're trying to accomplish. One is give workers the tools to expose employer wrongdoing, and the second is to give workers tools to hold law-breaking employers accountable. You've already heard from Representative Vega Peterson about the various ways that we're trying to do that. So I'm really just here to be a resource to you all and answer questions. I will start with some of the questions that were already asked, if that is all right. So with regards to Senator Thatcher's question about wage liens and what other states' experiences have looked like, this bill is closely modeled after a wage lien law that has existed in Wisconsin in one form or another since the 1970s, actually, in a form most closely resembling our bill since 2003. It's had a pretty impressive effect in Wisconsin. From some of the numbers I was able to find, they're seeing in the range of 80% of wage claims paid in full after the looking just at 2007 to 2012. So it's really having a huge impact there, and we haven't seen some of the problems that employers have been concerned about in terms of them no longer being able to get funding from banks or other sorts of concerns. The one difference I would note from Wisconsin statute to ours is we've tried to being responsive to concerns that were raised in 2013 with regards to this proposal. We've tried to increase the kind of due process available to employers by adding a way for employers to very simply without need for a lawyer to go to submit a request to BOLI to have the commissioner review the filing for the notice to make sure that there does appear to be a plausible wage claim there. And then we've also added a couple other ways that we think strengthen the bill in terms of still protecting the workers' right to be paid while also, you know, protecting employers as well. Then with regards to Senator Knope's question about where we came to that 3-year statute of limitations on, or sorry, 3-year record keeping requirement, we came to that as sort of a compromise. You know, there are some wage and hour laws like overtime that are slightly shorter statute limitations, but then minimum wage, for example, has a 6-year statute of limitations. So we chose 3 years as what we thought was a not too burdensome length of time for employers to keep records that would allow workers their full rights through that period that's allowed under the law. And then finally, I'll follow up on the attorney's fees issue. I do want to note that under Oregon law, already independent of this bill, and our bill would not change this, anytime a claim is brought in court in bad faith or is found to be frivolous, the party who's had to defend against that claim can get attorney's fees for that. So we're really dealing here with claims that are reasonable and yes.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for that, Bob.
Yeah.
Senator, did you
a natural question. So when the court determines in favor of the business that it wasn't reasonable, why wouldn't it be reasonable for them to be able to recoup their costs to defend themselves against something that the court found that wasn't reasonable or just?
Yeah. Chair Dembro, Senator Knope, I think there's a couple things sort of compressed into your question. You know, we can talk about a claim being reasonable, and then we can talk about whether it actually was proven. You know, there are, of course, reasonable ways to interpret a law differently, but then the court will make the ultimate decision on which interpretation prevails. And as to, you know, why give preference to the worker, I would really just defer back to the policy answer that Representative Vega Peterson stated so well, that it's really about, you know, protecting these extremely vulnerable individuals and giving them, you know, when you're talking about minimum wage workers, you're talking about those who could least afford to take that risk on themselves.
Other questions of this panel? Okay, thank you both very much.
Thank you,
Janet. Okay, I'm going to call up Tim Bernasek and Betsy Earls, please.
Just a little bit of last minute negotiating. Mr.
You
Chair,
always seem to win,
well,
Ms. Earls.
Only because there's no time to change it. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries, and appearing before you today in opposition to, in particular, some parts of Senate Bill 718. AOI is particularly concerned about the Lee's Pendants provisions of the bill in Section 8, in particular, an employee's ability to bring an action against an employer without first filing a claim for unpaid wages, which you see on page 8, and the ability to file a lien upon all property of the employer in the amount of unpaid wages. But since I am not practicing law in this area right now, I think it would probably be better for me to leave the details of the subject to Mr. Bernasek.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Bernasek. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Dunn, Carney, Allen, Higgins, and Tongue in Portland. I'm here representing the Oregon Farm Bureau today, and I spend a fair amount of my time in private practice representing employers primarily agricultural employers in these types of claims. So I guess it's with that background I'd like to comment on a couple of issues, a couple that have been raised by the panel and maybe one that has not, of specific concerns in the bill. There were some questions about the at-will employment section on page 5, section 5, sub 6. And if I can just read that section really quickly, the question, I think it was Senator Knope asked about what the impact on at-will employment was, and I think Senator Thatcher mentioned, well, what about if we just respond with a blank page? And I'm not sure that's an option. The section provides, upon receipt of a written request from a terminated employer, an employer shall provide to the employee a full, succinct, and complete written statement of the reason or reasons for the termination of the employee. So I don't know that there's an option there to not provide some response. So I don't know, but I think some implications on at-will employment are at issue here. But I think more significantly, I'd like to talk about what Ms. Earls mentioned, the Liz Pendens provisions in Section 8, Sub 1B, that allow the filing of a Liz Pendens notice on property, real or personal property, upon the filing of a wage complaint. And it's difficult to see exactly how this plays out, because traditionally what Liz Pendens has been used for is when there's a dispute between two property owners, and one of the property owners maybe is transferring that property to another. And the idea is that the purchaser of the property should be aware that there's some dispute about that property, the ownership of that property. Perhaps someone's claiming to be a tenant in common that may later, once a transfer occurs, the purchaser needs to be aware that, well, wait a minute, I'm buying this, and I think I'm buying it from the seller, but there's this claim out there that somebody else may have to that real property. And so what it does is it raises a concern that it's then flagged during the title insurance process, that an exception then is on title that you need to get cleared up, because there really is no way to insure against that exception. And so that's typically how Liz Pendens has worked. The question here is, when you have a wage complaint, so you've got a complaint that isn't tied to the property, this notice comes up, and it certainly could foul up the transaction for sure. But I'm thinking through this, wondering how this works. Let's say somebody was willing to purchase that property subject to this wage claim, so they purchase it before a determination has been made. I'm not sure what the Liz Pendens does, because when a judgment is entered, a property owner, an employee who has maybe this judgment can then go get a lien filed on the existing property of the employer. But if the property that this Liz Pendens notice was on has already been transferred, the lien wouldn't necessarily tie to that property. So it just doesn't fit very well the way I think about it. And it certainly, I think, adds a complication into real property law that I think is unexpected and will have a lot of real concerns. And then finally, I guess I would just highlight on page 10, this is an issue that hasn't come up yet, is this the way a lien can be filed on property. Under current law, of course, if an employee prevails in litigation and gets a judgment and goes through the whole due process notion of what our litigation system does, then there's a way to get that judgment turned into a lien onto the real property of the employer. This bill would open that up to allow a lien to be filed simply upon the finding of a wage commissioner and also upon an admission of an employer. And I think that raises some due process concerns. Certainly that there is a process when you go through an administrative process with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, but you still have the ability then to go to court and have process there. And this having a lien filed short of that full process, I think, is a significant change that causes great concern, I think, to many employers. So I'd be happy to answer questions related to these issues, or if I can, other questions that you may have. But those are, I think, the main concerns that we see that certainly the Farm Bureau and I think other employers would be concerned about this bill as it's written. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mernisak. I have a question. So you understand the you know, the purpose of, you know, what the advocates are trying to get at here, you know, in terms of, you know, the need to file a list pendants or a lien. Is there another way that we could get at this that you would suggest to meet that goal of, you know, that, you know, if an employee has been harmed, that we can make sure that there's an ability for them to get paid?
Well, I guess given the Chair Dembro, in response to your question, I think my sense would be our current process, I think, works quite well from the standpoint that there are attorney fee provisions if you have wronged an employee. I will tell you, as an attorney that represents a lot of employers, they have a lot at stake, you know, particularly in the agricultural context where, you know, my clients are paying hundreds of dollars an hour for their legal services, and most of the claims that I have are with Oregon Law Center, Oregon Legal Services, which provides a very needed service to farm workers, but that cost factor isn't there. And so I'll tell you, there's a real incentive for us to get to the bottom of these claims very quickly, because look, if we don't have a defense, you don't have a defense, and you're paying your own fees, but you also could be paying the other side's fees as well. So there's a litigation route, and then there also is Federal Department of Labor or the Bureau of Labor and Industries that investigate and prosecute these claims as well. So, you know, certainly we are, you know, colored by the seat that we sit in, but I will tell you, having represented an awful lot of employers, I will tell you that the economics of what it takes to employ someone like me to defend them oftentimes are 2, 3, 4 times could the cost of that to take it all the way through, 2, 3, 4, 5 times the cost of what the demand amount is. So I see a lot of employers that for economic reasons settle these cases simply because they cannot afford to litigate them, even though they feel very confident in the records that they have, that they have a good argument. So, you know, I guess that's how I see it. I don't have a good answer to your question other than I think the process does work. That doesn't mean there aren't situations where there is abuse, but I don't see that employers have some incentive to circumvent the law under the current system.
Okay, thank you. Questions of this panel? Yes, Senator.
Yeah, Tim, the issue that I brought up before in terms of the law, the way it is now, on page 7 of this bill, line 3 and 4, you know, the court may award a reasonable attorney's fees to, currently says, the prevailing party in any action brought by an employee under this section. The change has been made to eliminate prevailing party and just put plaintiff. So it seems pretty one-sided to me, and I was wondering, with your expertise in this, can you give us, I think you kind of gave us a general idea, but how often these wage claims actually are adjudicated versus settled, and then generally what kind of amount the attorney's fees might be if you take this case all the way to completion?
Chair Dembro, Senator Canope. Yeah, they're very, very expensive. I mean, they can be to take it all the way through litigation. That's why very, very few. I don't want to dare say give a percentage, but it is very, very rare to take these all the way through a final judgment, just because of the cost. Frankly, for both sides. I mean, litigation is. I think that's one of the issues that we struggle in the legal world in general, is just the cost of litigation generally, but particularly for employers and the agricultural employers that I tend to see, it's a real problem. I mean, if you these claims typically start with a demand letter, and so you'll analyze the claims and the demand. You'll talk to the employer, sort of find out if there's a problem, and if there is an issue there, that, you know, mistakes happen, and you settle it at that stage. It can be, you know, $1,000 or less. But if you start into the litigation process, which oftentimes you do, if an employer says, wait a minute, I've got a real claim here, just to get into the litigation process, oftentimes you'll go to mediation. You know, that can be tens of thousands of dollars just to get through some base litigation and then in through mediation. And, you know, I'll tell you a story of a client I had just 2 to 3 weeks ago settled a claim that that the amount was under $50,000, so it was subject to arbitration, so it wasn't subject to the normal trial process. But he said, and this a couple years ago, said, Tim, I don't care what it costs. I'm going to fight this all the way through. And so we went all the way through, and we were a week out from arbitration. He had probably in the six figures in attorney fees, well over twice what the cost of the judgment would be. He had some family issues come up, health of his mother and his wife at the same time, and so we ended up throwing in the towel and settling it. But that's where we were within a week of going to arbitration. It was six figures. So it is real. There are real incentives. And to take away, you know, one of the things that we looked at, you know, whether this particular plaintiff had the ability to pay the fees or not, during the wage claim, we did have the ability to at least, if we prevailed as we thought we would, to at least make a run at that. But this would take that away.
But if I could follow up on that, you can see that the existing practice could have a chilling effect on, you know, really low wage, low wealth individuals to bring a claim if they bring a claim in good faith and, you know, there's no sense that they're acting frivolously. They think they're right. And then they lose, and then they could be on the hook for attorney fees that, I mean, assuming if they're using legal aid, you know, they probably don't have resources. What do you do in that situation? I mean, I assume that that's the purpose for this change.
Yeah, Chair Jembro, that's a good point. I mean, I think it's the nature of these claims in general that when legal aid isn't available, which in many employees it's not, they rely primarily, in my experience, on attorneys that are willing to take these on a contingency fee basis. But when the claims are, again, these are significant to an employer, but, you know, $10,000, $12,000 claim, let's just pull one sort of an average one out of the air, a plaintiff's lawyer looking at that, you know, maybe they're going to get 25%, you know, that for the time into it, as I just was explaining to Senator Knope's question, is it is an issue, I will say, but again, to stack the deck so far against the employer on these particular issues of Liz Pendens and lien processes where, you know, due process concerns that, you say what you will about our judicial process, there are reasons why it is the way it is, and to circumvent them in this way and foul up the sort of real estate transactions and then having liens filed and then taking away, it doesn't say that a judge has to award attorney fees, it's just that they may. And to take that away, we think is there's inequities here, but that too is a great inequity.
Okay, thank you both for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to call up Andrea Miller, Graham Traynor, and Stacey Cowan, please.
Hi, good morning,
welcome.
Chair, members of the committee. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
I always forget these are very sensitive.
No, it's good. You don't even
good.
Have to
I
be close.
I remember I sit right here, not too close. My name's Andrea Miller, for the record. I'm the executive director of CAUSA, which, as you know, is an organization that has represented Latino families for the past 20 years. And I'm here to support Senate Bill 718, the Fair Wage Recovery Act, which would help address the growing problem of wage theft. As we've said earlier, this impacts a diverse set of workers. But of course, as CAUSA, we're going to emphasize how much it really does impact women, people of color, and immigrants. This means for groups like CAUSA, wage theft is not just a justice issue, it's also an equity issue. There's some interesting data on this. For example, Latino workers are especially susceptible, as I said, but foreign-born Latino workers have the highest minimum wage violation rates of any racial or ethnic group, according to a 2009 study of pay violations experienced by low-wage workers. That's pretty stark to us, and you've heard earlier that a study looking at farm workers, I mean, it's also the disparity is there as well. And this is just really unacceptable for us, and we commend you all for looking at this issue and finding solutions for it. as many of you would agree, this isn't right. It's also not legal. And at CAUSA, we hear far too often too many phone calls from workers saying that they've experienced wage theft or being paid less than the minimum wage. Many are struggling and are afraid to speak up due to fear of retaliation and wanting to keep their jobs because they know if that they lose their job, then they're even further down, you know, in paying their bills and making their budget. And those that do speak up face additional barriers. So we do really see this bill as providing some powerful set of tools for the hands of the workers to reclaim some of their wages for the hard work that they've been doing. So thank you, and I urge your support on this bill.
Thank you, Andrea. Stacy, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. Stacy Cowan with SEIU. I'm with Local 503. I'm here today representing the Service Employees International Union of Oregon. I'll keep my comments brief. We just wanted an opportunity to add our voice to the discussion today, and we are in support of Senate Bill 718. SEIU of Oregon represents 65,000 workers statewide. Many of these workers are employed in industries like janitorial or other services where wage and hour abuses often occur. When workers are denied the pay that they are owed, it hurts the economy. We've heard a little bit about this before, but it denies workers fair pay, and it really creates an uneven playing field for employers who follow the law. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and with that, I'll just say we urge your support for the bill.
Thank you. Graham.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, my name is Graham Trainer. I'm here today representing the Oregon AFL-CIO that represents over 300,000 working Oregonians and as a voice for all workers in the legislative process. Our members work in many sectors of Oregon's economy, some of which are quite prone to wage theft, but our interest in this issue is, I would argue, more importantly on behalf of workers that may never be represented by a union or covered by a collective bargaining agreement. Despite Oregon's economic recovery and by some standards and economy on firm footing, many in today's workforce are still getting left behind. We know that over 400,000 Oregon workers currently do low-wage work, many of whom also rely on public assistance to provide for their families, and it's clear that today's economy looks much different than it did before the Great Recession. The 2015 Oregon legislature is considering a host of proposals and approaches to address economic inequality. And from our perspective, if we're not also talking about wage theft as an undercutting force in our entire economy, at the same time these other types of policies are being discussed, we're leaving behind even further a segment of workers in Oregon who don't even have access to the minimum standards provided by the law, and many of whom are often voiceless and without advocacy tools to improve their situation. And, you know, there are clearly a number of important approaches to fighting wage theft. You've heard about a number of them today. We recognize and appreciate the role at the agency level to address issues around wage theft. However, we believe that an agency approach alone is not enough, and that Senate Bill 718 provides vital tools to workers that can better help them expose employer wrongdoing and reduce barriers so that they can get help and recover the wages they are owed. And we at the Oregon AFL-CIO strongly urge your support for Senate Bill 718 to make a statement that the state of Oregon will work to end wage theft.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, thank you, all three
Thanks.
Of you. So we're going to keep this this public hearing open, but I'm also going to open a hearing now on Senate Bill 19 because we have an illustrious presenter. Thank you, Senator Shields. And this bill that you're presenting is very much in line, I think, of the topic here. But, Matt, why don't you tell us what Senate Bill 19 does?
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, Senate Bill 19 establishes joint and severable liability for a person who aids or abets an employer in paying an employee less than the wages required. I meant several. There's yet to be a fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields, and I represent Senate District 22, North and Northeast Portland, in the Oregon State Senate. And I'm very gratified that you were continuing to work on those previous issues that my committee last session made some advances on, but still have a lot more work to go. So I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 19, which would make a person who aids or abets an employer in violating the state's wage and hour laws personally, jointly, and severally liable with the employer. And it essentially is here to address an issue where a wage judgment has been made against a business. That business is not paying, and then the principals pop up with a new entity in the hopes of hiding behind that new corporate veil or LLC veil. I asked Boley for a few examples to illustrate the problem of what we were trying to address here with Senate Bill 19, and here are just two. Example one, GNR Custom Homes and Drywall Specialty Contractor, LLC. A GNR was a limited liability company contracted to perform the installation of drywall and acoustical ceilings on a project at Southern Oregon University. About 25 wage claims were filed against GNR, alleging that the contractor had failed to pay several weeks of wages to its employees working on this project. After an extensive investigation, Boley obtained a judgment against GNR in the amount exceeding $350,000. To date, GNR has paid zero of the wages and penalties owed. GNR was administratively dissolved in March 2014 and appears to have gone out of business. However, in July 2014, just a couple months later, one of the members of GNR organized a new company. They continued to run the company even though they have not paid a dime and continued to ignore their obligation to pay wages owed to their previous employees. Example number two, ASM Drywall and Construction. The owner of an outfit called S&S Drywall was convicted of criminal antitrust racketeering and firearm violations in state court and subsequently of tax evasion charges in federal court. The owner shut down S&S and transferred operations to his sister under ASM Drywall and Construction. Boley received wage claims from 19 workers against ASM, eventually obtaining a judgment against the corporation for an amount exceeding $160,000 in unpaid wages and penalties. ASM then went out of business, and Boley was able to pay some of the unpaid wages from the Wage Security Fund, but a good portion of that judgment amount has not been paid. So these are just two examples, and there are other cases where Boley has obtained a judgment against a business entity for unpaid wages. The business entity is not paid, but the persons who operated the business have continued to operate other companies without paying a dime they owe to their previous employees. As you know, business laws generally shield persons operating a corporation or a limited liability company from responsibility for actions such as failing to pay wages or otherwise violating wage and hour laws. SB 19 would make those persons who do not pay wages responsible for the non-payment. SB 19 is a necessary tool to make sure that we recover wages from bad acting companies that do not pay their employees. It will also level the playing field for good businesses. And if you are a business who pays your employees, you should support this bill so that your competitors are forced to play on a fair playing field as well. I urge your support of Senate Bill 19, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Senator. Colleagues, any questions of the Senator? Okay, thank you.
Thank you,
you
very
for
much.
Bringing this
Appreciate
forward. we have a few people to speak to this bill, but I'd like to go back to the previous one, and we have two more panels I'd like to get through, and then we'll come back to this. So we'll keep both of them open. So I'd like to bring up Edgar Valdez, Rafael Ortiz, Rafael Soto, and Ramon Ramirez. Can we fit four up there?
Buenas tardes. Mi nombre es Rafael Soto.
Estoy Good afternoon. Aquí. My name is Rafael Soto.
Estoy aquí en apoyo a la proposición de ley SB 718.
I'm here in support of Senate Bill 718.
Yo y tres trabajadores más trabajé para un patrón.
I'm here to testify saying that I was part of a three-person crew.
Limpiando techos de apartamentos.
That was cleaning buildings, apartment buildings.
Por 52 días. Y nunca nos pagaron.
And I worked a total of 52 days and never got paid during that time.
Este patrón quedó a deber un total de $2,544.
During that time, this employer owed me a total of $2,544 for the work that I did.
Por mi trabajo realizado, este patrón nunca me pagó y todavía me debe.
This employer never paid me then, and he, up to now, he's never paid me.
Por eso estoy aquí para apoyar esta ley, ya que si tuviéramos herramientas más eficaces que nos ayuden a recuperar nuestro dinero.
That's why I'm here to support Senate Bill 718, because if we were given resources, legal resources, I wouldn't be in the situation that I'm in, and also to protect workers in the future that might find themselves in my situation.
Robado nuestros, no tendríamos que perder nuestro dinero que tanto trabajo y dignidad hemos ganado.
Not only did I lose my wages, but I lost my dignity as a worker.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Rafael Soto.
Thank you very much. My name is Ramon Ramirez. Good afternoon, Senator Denbrough and members of the committee. I'm president of the Oregon Farmworker Union, PECUN. And on behalf of our 6,500 members, I want to express our full support for Senate Bill 718. Wage theft in our community is a reality. Wage theft among farm workers or farm workers not making minimum wage is also a reality, a harsh reality in our community. Over the past several years, PECUN has been involved in documenting and recovering wages for hundreds and hundreds of workers in agriculture and outside agriculture. In fact, the report that was mentioned twice in previous testimonies about a report that came out, we actually authored the report in 2009. And what we found was, after interviewing 250 farm workers in piece rate crops in the Willamette Valley, in the northern Willamette Valley, piece rate crops are those crops that are paid by what you pick. We found wholesale violations of minimum wage laws. And what we did, rather than what we normally do, would be like to call for a big press conference and denounce it and give agriculture a big black eye. We actually did the opposite, because we felt we wanted to develop a different tactic, and maybe we would go to the growers. And we did. We actually went to the Farm Bureau, we went to the Nursery Association, and we went to Boley, and we gave them the report. We didn't even announce it to the press. We went to those organizations and say, wage theft among farm workers is got to stop. And there was acknowledgement that it was happening. And in fact, I want to applaud the Bureau of Labor and Industries, because what the commissioner did was actually pull together some working groups among the growers and among the farm worker advocates. And we started having community sessions, and he targeted based on our study that this was happening in strawberries. So he pulled a lot of the strawberry growers together and just said, hey, this is the law, and this is the way it should this is the way that work that you need to do, regardless of whether you pay piece rate or not. You got to pay the worker a minimum wage. So in my packet, you'll see in my testimony, you'll see a determination letter that was done by the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Soto was one of the workers that our union represented. There were 16 workers that were owed a total of about $79,000, close to $80,000, for working 52 days without getting paid. And some might ask, well, how did you work so long, 52 days, and not get paid? Mm-hmm. Well, this person would lead them to believe that he was going to pay them. Every so often, every 2 weeks, hey, the check's in the mail, by the end of the month, and he just lured them on for 52 days and never paid them 1 cent. We did what we could, and we filed wage claims with Boley. And the wage claim is in your the determination is in my testimony. And what we so what happened was that this this labor contractor, this employer, even though he has a judgment against him, continues to operate today. And by the definition of the law, that is criminal. What's the difference between that employer robbing $80,000 to 16 workers and going into the U.S. bank and robbing it at gunpoint? What is the difference at the end of the day? And that's what happened to this gentleman and 15 other workers. And I know that the 718 asked some questions about you know whether or not we can put a lien on some property or not. But the fact of the matter is that we need tools to go after those employers. And I'm not saying all employers, right? Because there's a lot of good employers. We have contracts with several of them that are really good and do the right thing. But what do we do to go after those employers that are ripping off workers, and not only ripping off those workers and their families, but ripping off our community and the state by not paying revenue? Much needed revenues that can go to educate our children. And that's what wage theft does in our community. So that's why PECUN urges this committee to pass 718, because we think that this is an effective way, and we're not gonna solve all the wage fraud problems, because there are employers that are really bad out there that are thieves. But if you're doing the right thing and you make a mistake, this law doesn't really pertain to you. We're trying to go after those employers that are robbing our society by robbing our workers, our most valuable assets in our community. These are the people that put food on our table day in and day out. And we gotta do something about it. Maybe 718 could do some tweaking here and there, you know, to make it effective, more effective. But I think it is sound policy. And it's time that this building does something to come to the aid to the people that provide a valuable service to our community. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ramirez. Okay. Mr. Valdez?
Hi, good afternoon, guys. Chair Vice Chair Thatcher and members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Edgar Valdez, and I live in Portland, Oregon. I am here in support of the Senate Bill 718 because I don't want other workers to face what I'm going through right now. I started working for a distributor company, and I was working there for almost 2.5 years. I was originally hired as an independent contractor. Due to the lack of my knowledge, I never actually worked as an independent contractor. I didn't know what exactly meant until after a few months, I realized there were things that they were not adding up. For example, I wasn't getting a paycheck like anybody else. I was getting paid on commission, and I didn't really know how to calculate my pay because I didn't have a pay stub. And every time I brought it up to my employer, they would get upset even if I was claiming 15, 20, 30 bucks, and I was working on commission. I didn't have an actual salary or wage. Oh, I didn't have any wages like anybody else. So if I didn't sell anything, I wasn't making no money. Sometimes I was working for 10, 14 hours, and I was making 100, 150 bucks. So I was making less than minimum wage. And perhaps many people can think, well, how come you didn't do anything about it? And I actually did, because I started doing some research about things that I could actually do to protect myself. And many times I had talks with the employer, and their response was, well, you can either stay here or you can go. I mean, it's up to you. I don't really care. And unfortunately, since I was misclassified as an independent contractor, I had a tax issues, because instead of getting my W-2s, I was getting a 1099. When the time came around to do my taxes, and I went to see my accountant, he asked me, well, I'm gonna ask you these questions because I see that you have a 1099. So he asked me multiple questions, and he's like, you're not an independent contractor, you're an employee. and you have to pay over $5,000. And I only earned that year $28,000. And at the point, at the time, my fiance was expecting a baby, so I didn't want to leave the job because I didn't have any other type of income to support myself at the time. And it's very unfortunate that we have to go through this and to lose money, time. Today, I actually have to take time off because I truly, I don't want anybody else to go through what I'm going through, because I still gotta fix my issues with the IRS, and that's I'm working on that. And you guys have the power to actually take care of this problem by helping us with this bill. And I hope my testimony can help you guys, you know, to understand a little bit what we go through every single day to work for 10, 14 hours, working for 5:30 in the morning until like 8 o'clock and getting paid $100. That's unbelievable. You know, thank you guys.
Thank you for coming down, Mr. Valdez. Let's see, Ms. Ortiz? No? Rafael?
May I ask Rafael Ortiz?
My name is Rafael Ortiz.
But
sometimes they don't pay with pay stubs. Sometimes we don't know what he pays. Sometimes they only told me they don't have money, they went to bankruptcy. Saying that there are no ways to pay. I hope that you guys can help me with this 718 bill so that I can get paid. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ortiz. And thank you for translating. Mm-hmm. Any questions of this panel, colleagues? Okay, thank you very much for giving us your stories in your own words. Thank you. Okay, we have one final panel on this issue, on this bill. We're still on 718, and that's Jan Elfers and Michael Dale, please. Welcome.
Okay. Senator Dimbrough, Senator Thatcher, and members of the Senate Workforce Committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Jan Elfers. I am the Public Policy Director at Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, or EMO. EMO members are religious denominations, congregations, interfaith organizations, and community-based ministries located throughout the state in both rural and urban areas. We urge your support of Senate Bill 718. I'm speaking to you today on behalf of our constituents, which includes both employers and employees who sit in our churches and synagogues and temples, attend our places of worship, as well as those who use our ministries to obtain food and other vital services. Our scriptures are clear, thou shalt not steal. From Deuteronomy we read, employees must pay the wages due to their workers because the worker is needy and urgently depends on it. I had a couple of stories to share with you today about clients who come to our own Northeast Emergency Food Program and have told us about their unpaid wages. One, a landscaper who works per job. He's paid an hourly wage, but his employer says you have to finish the job before you go home. So he's often working 2 or 3 hours a day that he's not paid for. Another, a home care worker who takes care of a person who's in bed, and the family pays her on a contract, but they often come home 2 or 3 hours later than they say she's paid for, and she also loses precious wages that she needs to pay for groceries for her family. Excuse me.
These are hugely sensitive.
Groceries for her family, pay for her rent. Clearly, these two workers are examples of those in our midst who are least able to suffer the loss of wages and are being taken advantage of by their employer. I am really privileged and proud to stand with the panelists who spoke so eloquently before me. As people of faith, we must not be silent about this. This is wrong. It's unethical. Wage theft harms us all, workers who are typically vulnerable and earn very low wages. The majority of employers, including our own members who are honest, and our communities who bear the responsibility to help those in need. Wage theft exploits people. It is unjust, and Oregon's faith communities will not be silent. Senate Bill 718 is a fair approach to combating wage theft. It will help ensure the ethical treatment of our workers. And we ask you as legislators, we depend upon you to solve societal issues, and this one is an important one for you to solve. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane. Sir Dale.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dale. I'm an attorney with the Northwest Workers Justice Project, and I also work with the Oregon Coalition to Stop Wage Theft. I have written testimony, which I've provided. I'm not going to go through all of it, but I would just simply say that we believe there are some reasons why it isn't by accident that wage theft occurs at the level that it does in the state of Oregon. We believe there's some reasons. And teasing out at least four reasons, we've tried to address them with this bill. And the four reasons would be these. First of all, Oregon law already requires workers receive an adequate pay stub and that wage and hour records be made and maintained by employers. But the problem is that you still have to prove your case. And so it may be that the employers, it's the employer's bad that there are no records. But you need those records to prove your case. And if those records aren't available, then you lose your case. And this provides perverse incentives, it seems to me, that it rewards people for not meeting their duties and that there ought to be some remedy that the worker could assert in that circumstance. Secondly, people are afraid. They're afraid of retaliation if they complain. And we attempt to address that, and I'll talk about that more in a minute. Third, it's very difficult for workers to get assistance. As a practical matter, either need assistance of BOLI, which has limited resources and limited locations in the state, or alternatively, you have to get a lawyer. You can't do it on your own. Now, getting a lawyer isn't so easy, and we've heard some about that, and we'd like to make it easier for people to be able to obtain legal assistance. Just to give you a sense of this, in our small office, we're able to handle about 100 cases a year, and that represents somewhere around 275 workers on average. in those cases. But we turn away an average of 280 cases a year that, because of lack of resources, we can't reach. Now, we attempt to refer those cases, and so I'm quite familiar with the way that these cases are evaluated. They're very difficult to refer. Now, if it's a well-known employer with a huge workforce and lots of workers that are ready to go, no problem. You can find representation for that. But if it's a small employer with only a few plaintiffs, maybe only one, for that family, not getting paid wages is just as egregious as it is in a big case. But unfortunately, it's not a very attractive case to lawyers. And here, I think lawyers sometimes get a bad name for, you know, not taking on every issue. But they're small businessmen too, and they have to also figure out, well, how am I gonna pay my staff, how I'm going to pay the rent, and they can't just, they have to be able to see where it is that they're going to be able to earn some income from the work they do. Many do work pro bono without expectation, but there's just not enough there to be able to get the lawyer assistance that's needed. And then finally, the other reason wage theft exists is that it's so hard to collect a judgment once you establish it in court or through BOLI. And you've heard some testimony already about that. I won't belabor it other than just to say that in the 10 years that Northwest Workers Justice Project has been in operation, we've accrued a total of $850,000 in judgments on behalf of 88 workers that we have not been able to collect. And that's just our small firm. So it's not just that BOLI has difficulty collecting these judgments. It's hard to collect them. And some of the examples that Senator Shields gave kind of tells you why. I would like to take this opportunity also to address a few of the questions that have come up during the course of the hearing. There was a question about whether the requirement that there be a statement of reasons for discharge if the worker asks for the same, whether that somehow impinged upon or changed the traditional law in Oregon of at-will employment. It is not intended to do so. I think that I forget which one of you it was that read the statute as saying it's not good enough just to hand back a blank piece of paper. That's, I think, a correct reading of the statute. But you can say whatever your reasons are. You can say, I have no particular reason. It just wasn't working out. You can say I had no reason. There was a personality conflict. You can say whatever you want. The only point of this is that whatever you do say, you have to say the same thing consistently in the future after that. If someone calls for a reference, that's your reason. If someone says along the way, but, you know, this just happened to happen 2 days after I made a wage complaint, and I think it was because of a wage complaint, well, you're stuck with, I had no reason, and that's the reason. And you can't say, well, it wasn't really this reason, it was some other reason. He was hitting on the cafeteria women, and we just can't have that, you know, and just kind of make things up. And you know, it basically is, you declare that's your reason, and you rise or fall by that, and that's the intent. But certainly it is not the intent. And I don't believe it's the effect of the language of the bill to change Oregon's traditional law of being able to hire or fire employees at will, providing that you're not doing it for a explicitly legal reason.
Thanks, Michael. And we'll have to finish in a couple minutes, so you could wrap up.
Okay. Two other things. The fees question. Why would we make fees one-sided? I'd point out, first of all, that if the case is frivolous, under current Oregon law, fees are awardable irrespective of the statute. Secondly, an employer is in a better position somewhat to absorb a loss of fees than is a plaintiff, because they are in business and those fees are deductible costs, federally deductible and deductible under state income, so it's not quite as burdensome. The third point I would make about this is that the real function of fee shifting in this area is really the interorum effect, the effect of discouraging people from bringing claims, because I think Mr. Bernasek kind of summed up and says, well, we'll kind of try to collect our fees. If there's a $100,000 fee award, you're not going to get it from a minimum wage worker. Let's face it. The only point is to have that club hang over the person's head. Last, the lien. There are actually two other states that have a similar lien law. Maryland has adopted a very similar law, and this same bill is under consideration in a couple of other states. Actually, Oregon has lien law that's very similar to this, but only in limited areas of the economy. For example, in Mr. Bernasek's case, he represents agricultural employers. Farm workers can assert a lien. They can assert a crop lien, and they do so without having any due process. They just go down to the – I've filed those liens myself. They just go down to the county and say, I claim a lien for my wages against this. The problem is that it's only available to a few workers like construction workers and farm workers. There hasn't been great problem or difficulty under existing statutes. The Liz Pindus language is causing some difficulties. The reason that we put that into that instead of just saying you have a lien is so that workers, when they assert the lien, don't get the lien right away. They have to go first through a process to establish their entitlement to the lien. All it's saying is, there's some dispute going on here. Not necessarily entitled to it, there's some dispute. They have to promptly, within 120 days, bring an action or the lien goes away. They're only entitled to actually file a lien under the circumstance that they've established that they're owed the money. There's some question about whether an admission would be a denial of due process. If the employer admits that they owe the money, that's not a denial of due process. They're conceding the point. And then finally, a BOLI award isn't a denial of due process. BOLI awards result under statute in a full judgment under the law after a procedure that has a due process built into it. So we're not shorting people of an access to the courts.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Colleagues, did you have any questions of these two? Okay, thank you both very much for coming. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 718. We're still under Senate Bill 19, and so I'd like to call up Mike Eliason and Betsy Earls, please. Betsy had to step out. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks. Chair Jembro, members of the committee, Mike Eliason with the Associated General Contractors, here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 19, at least as it's currently drafted. I'll make a couple of general and specific comments, and then, in the interest of time, be done. Generally, we feel like this bill is written much too broadly. We're unclear exactly how it'll solve the problem that was cited by the good senator in his opening remarks. And we would note that, at least as we read the bill, the folks who are most likely would be found to be aiding or abetting a wage rate violation would probably be controllers or bookkeepers who either have simply made innocent mistakes or don't fully understand the extent of the wage classifications or compliance obligations. But with more specifically in the bill to Section 7, which deals with ORS 279C, which is the public works, public construction statutes. Public prevailing wage in particular is exceedingly complicated, and even experienced contractors sometimes make mistakes. A couple of common examples: failure to pay the correct zone pay for a contractor who's working at a remote location, or the failure to properly calculate prevailing wage fringe benefits. And by using that broad term, aid and abet, and establishing joint and several liability for anyone who does so, we feel like that is casting a very wide net. And moreover, the public contracting statutes and public contracting in general is a very heavily regulated industry. For example, every contractor who is performing a public works project must obtain a public works bond, which is designed specifically to address underpayment or non-payment of wages or prevailing wage. Public contractors must also obtain payment and performance surety bonds, which BOLI can claim on behalf of laborers or workers to ensure the correct payment of prevailing wage. On private construction jobs, I think it was just referred to a few moments ago, workers are entitled to record liens against real property to ensure their rights to be paid correctly. And then again, both the CCB and BOLI have the authority for truly bad actors to pursue debarment. So we're not sure this bill is particularly well conceived. We know there are other conversations going on around the building on various other concepts, but we're not sure this increases protections or remedies to affected workers. With that, I'll close.
Thank you, Mr. Lyson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and appearing in opposition to Senate Bill 19. I feel like getting up here and opposing these bills, it sounds like AOI is supporting wage theft. And I know that there's been a lot of conversation about wage theft in this building this session, and a lot of concern about it in Oregon. And let me just be clear that nothing about our comments or opposition to these bills means that we are trying to support people who are involved in wage theft. And we do support trying to find a comprehensive solution to the problem. It seems like we have a number of bills around the Capitol this session that deal with the issue in different ways. And it also seems like it might be good at some point to kind of get those together, have a comprehensive look at the problem and the issues that Oregon is experiencing, or Oregon workers are experiencing, and put together one solution to move forward with. So that said, the only comment that I would make in addition to what Mike said to you about Senate Bill 19 that we have a particular concern about is that there doesn't appear to be any requirement of intent in the bill about people that are aiding and abetting. The bill doesn't say that somebody has to be knowingly aiding and abetting another person who is paying lower wages than are actually required. And we're concerned that the bill as it's written could lead to people who have made honest mistakes or genuine bookkeeping or calculation errors being painted with the same brush as others that are, involved in what appears to be genuine wage theft in a lot of cases. So that's my testimony, and I would be happy to work with proponents or whoever going forward on a comprehensive solution.
Thank you for that offer. I assume that applies to you, Mike, as well.
Chair Dembro, yes, it does.
Thank you. Questions, colleagues? Okay, thank you both very much. Our final panel on this is Paloma Sparks. And again, Michael Dale, please. Paloma?
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, Paloma Sparks for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 19, which would allow the commissioner to also go after individuals who are directly responsible for wage theft in addition to the businesses. The intent behind the bill is to get to the people who have intentionally created a system. It's certainly not to get to people like bookkeepers who have inadvertently created a mistaken situation. Most importantly, there are businesses that have patterns of closing up to avoid liability. We want to get to those individuals who clearly owe wages to workers. So that's my testimony, and if you have any questions, happy to answer them.
Thank you, Paloma. Michael, on this issue?
Again, for the record, Michael Dale from the Northwest Worker Justice Project and testifying on behalf of the Oregon Coalition to Stop Wage Theft. This bill closes an important loophole in Oregon's wage and hour law. It is normal that agents of corporations, in first year of law school, you learn this, agents of corporations acting on behalf of the corporation aren't personally liable for their actions. Wage and hour law is an important exception to that. Anyone who is large enough to be covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that's most businesses really, already is covered by a provision that I've cited in my testimony that holds agents of the corporation to be jointly and severally liable for wage theft that they have contributed to. This bill does it in a slightly different way, but it closes that loophole, which means that everyone is treated the same. If they're a private business that's not incorporated, they're responsible. If they work for a large corporation and they deliberately violate the law, they're responsible. And this would say, and if you're also in a small corporation, you're responsible. It fills that hole, but it fills it in three different ways, because first of all, BOLI doesn't enforce federal law. And so BOLI can't invoke that provision of federal law. It can only use state law. And so it is sort of hobbled with one hand tied behind his back in that sense. Secondly, obviously, for smaller, again, looking at it from the standpoint of a worker, it doesn't really matter if you work for a big employer or a small employer. If you don't get paid, you don't get paid. Corporations don't violate the law. Their people violate the law, and they should be held accountable to the same degree. So for these reasons, the Oregon Coalition strongly supports Senate Bill 19.
Thank you, Michael. Questions of either panelist? Okay, thank you both very much. Okay, with that, I'm going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 19. Colleagues, I'll let you know about the next steps for these bills. I am going to have us carry over our public hearing on Senate Bill 786. So if anyone was here to speak to that, come back on Wednesday. We know that Senator Knoop will, because he wouldn't miss this for anything. But anyone else who is here will deal with Senate Bill 786 on Wednesday. We cannot do our work session on Senate Bill 496, but we can on Senate Bill 128. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 128. And Matt, can you tell us where we are in this bill?
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. Senate Bill 128.
Remind us what it is.
Sorry, yes. It defines comparable for the purpose of establishing base pay for the Department of State Police telecommunicators as the base pay for telecommunicators employed by the five Oregon public safety answering points with the most employees. And this particular bill has a series of amendments. We are now on the Dash 3 level, and the fiscal impact for the Dash 3s has just been released during this meeting today.
Thank you, Matt. Vice Chair Thatcher.
Can we talk about what the Dash 3 amendments do, please?
Yeah, well,
yes. The Dash 3 amendments make this bill effective for future arbitration hearings, and so it won't take effect under the current agreement.
Okay, thank you. I feel a little better. Okay, I Move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 128, dated March 2nd, 2015.
Vice Chair Thatcher moves to adopt the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 128, dated March 2nd, 2015. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, is there any objection to our adopting this amendment? Okay, seeing none, so ordered. Vice Chair Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 128 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Thatcher moves Senate Bill 128 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to this being sent to the Committee on Ways and Means? Seeing none, so ordered. Okay, I'm going to close this work session on Senate Bill 128. Colleagues, anything else for the good of the order? Then I will adjourn this hearing and let it be noted at exactly 2:45.